My upbringing is such that I believe that there are certain things, certain types of conduct that are immoral. I believe that military members who sleep with other military members' wives are immoral in their conduct, and that we should not tolerate that. I believe that homosexual acts between individuals are immoral, and that we should not condone immoral acts.
That is Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace, earlier this week, speaking freely to the Chicago Tribune about his opinions regarding adultery and homosexuality as it pertains to military service. He hasn't backed off, he hasn't apologized, but he did say it was more of his opinion than his thoughts on the policy. It's one of our issues, etc. Soundbites of the week. You get a chance to vote for that one or for the other three coming up here in about an hour and a half on Issues, etc. In the meantime, Saturday is St. Patrick's Day. While it's not a day I generally observe, unless my wife would be so kind as to bring home some delicious corned beef. I like the pastrami variety that's got the pepper on the outside. Yeah, baby, that's my kind of corned beef. Big corned beef sandwich, that'll be the extent of my St. Patrick's Day celebration. Many people will be drinking their green beer or wearing their green shamrocks or walking around in a stupor. Not me. Well, not at least until I'm done with my pastrami sandwich. That would probably cause a stupor enough. Pastor Greg Olms joins us to talk about the real St. Patrick. He has a contribution that he left behind, or at least he's reputed to have left behind, that is remarkable. Has nothing to do with shamrocks or green beer. Pastor Greg Olms is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Catawba, North Carolina, and he's author of the blog Incarnatus Est. Pastor Olms, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Do you like corned beef?
Sure. Haven't had it in a while, actually. You were making me hungry as you were speaking.
Actually, I like the German treatment of corned beef a little better with the Reuben sandwich. Why all the green associated? Even the icon that we found of St. Patrick for our website has him be clad in green.
Well, you know, it's a good question, and certainly green is a large part of what we associate with St. Patrick. And all that I know, I mean, St. Patrick is, you know, lots of saints are surrounded with lots of legends. I don't believe there's a saint as associated with as many and various legends as St. Patrick is. And I believe, and this is an educated guess on my part, that the green mainly comes from the legend of the shamrock and the three-leaf clover and the you know, the teaching that St. Patrick did concerning the Trinity, the three-in-one using a clover. And my guess would be it started from there, and I don't know of any other greenness. I'm sure there's some other facets to that, but I think the base of it is that the shamrock and the clover thing.
There's something that is associated, a poem that is associated with St. Patrick and has long been associated with him, usually called St. Patrick's Breastplate, or the Lorica is another name for it. And it is truly remarkable, a Christ hymn of just unbelievable proportions and depth. Talk about that. We could spend the whole half hour talking about it, but before we get into the Patrick bio, talk about this hymn that is left behind associated with him.
Well, as you say, it is a remarkable hymn, and I think we'd properly say that it is associated with St. Patrick rather than authored by him, a product of his followers and of the piety and the devotion to Christ and to the Trinity that he left behind, and it is a remarkable hymn, you know, serves as one of those things that just in general that, you know, as Lutherans we are so fortunate to be in the you know, to be heirs to that kind of material and those kinds of hymns and material that come down from the early church through the Western Church to us, and to be able to sing a hymn like that, I'm not always sure our people realize the depth, and you know, quite apart, you know, just from the confession of faith it makes, but to be able to trace that back very close to St. Patrick himself, back into the 400s, and then to be able to confess that ourselves in word and music is quite remarkable. It never fails to strike me, emotionally, when we use that hymn.
Would it be appropriate for a church today that might observe St. Patrick's Day on Saturday to have a recitation or a reading of St. Patrick's breastplate?
Sure. I think one of the lessons of that we get from St. Patrick is a devotion to the doctrine of the Trinity and certainly to Christ. And if you read some of the material he left behind, which is very slight in his own hand, but and what better way to honor him than that? Even, he said historically it was not written by him, but that points us directly to his legacy, and that's why we remember the saints, that they might direct us to Christ and to salvation.
How does he come to be so strongly associated with the defense of the Scriptures' doctrine of the Trinity?
Well, his story, which quite apart from the legends associated with him, is remarkable all on its own. But he was a missionary pastor and was sent probably by the British Church, perhaps by the Roman Church, by the Pope. But in any event, was sent from Britain into Ireland, and there was already some Christian settlements in Ireland when he went. In fact, he was not the first Christian to be sent from outside that we know of. That belongs to a different person, that honor. But Pelagianism and Arianism were making inroads at this time all over the empire and in Britain and in Ireland. And one of the reasons that Palladius, who was sent right around the same time, but before Patrick, was specifically to combat Pelagianism. And in the writings of St. Patrick, they're quite strong on the defense of the Trinity. And one of the reasons, and one of his works was, besides being a missionary, which is his main contribution, was to defend the doctrine of the Trinity and Orthodox teaching, both against Pelagians and against Arians.
Patrick was commissioned to go and combat this spreading error, first of Pelagianism, that a teaching that man has a natural capacity to find God, that really is man's responsibility to find God's mercy rather than God to find man in his fallen state.
Mm-hmm.
And Arianism, a terrible garbling of what Scripture teaches regarding the person of Christ and his divinity and his humanity. His dates are 5th century. Is he stamping out the last vestiges of these errors as he goes to Ireland?
Well, Arianism, Pelagianism would be, still around. Arianism, of course, flourished. And the big controversy was in the early part of the 4th century, 325 Council of Nicaea. But Arianism lingered, especially on the edges of the empire and in some of the barbarian kingdoms that converted and also within the empire, stayed around for a long time. So was still a worry. Just to clear, Patrick himself wasn't commissioned specifically to combat those heresies. Palladius, we know, was by Pope Celestine in Rome, but it was a part of his work. But yes, vestiges, and again, on the fringes of the empire, and remember, we're in Britain, we're in Ireland, which, in the Roman scheme of things is frontier country, so the reach of the church was not as strong in those areas, so there was some opportunity for heretics and folks that had been condemned by the church to have a hand there. So that was one of the things Patrick did and one of the things he was remembered for.
You've mentioned kind of the scant existence of his writings. What are they that can give us some insight?
Yes. Well, there's two of them only two that survive. A confession. Both of them are letters. The Confession of St. Patrick is the longer one. The other one is a letter that he wrote protesting some of his... members, I believe, had been excommunicated, and then they had been kidnapped or some such thing. But the confession is a defense of his life and his work that he wrote in his own hand, called The Confession of St. Patrick, and quite interesting to read. And he had been under some criticism for various things, and he wrote this as a defense. And he spells out his own beliefs in a creedal statement, which very reminiscent of the Apostles' Creed, and then just recounts his whole life and his ministry, how he went about his ministry, because that was some accusations were being made. And so that Confession of St. Patrick, which isn't too long, you know, maybe 8 or 10 pages, is his main work. And that's really the main information we have about him is from that confession that he wrote.
We're talking with Pastor Greg Alms, pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Catawba, North Carolina. He's author of the blog Incarnatus Est. We're talking about St. Patrick. Saturday, of course, is St. Patrick's Day. Let's talk about the legends that have grown up around him. You kind of speculated on the origin of the green association with him. What about the other legends or the things that have spun off from Patrick's life, where we end up with a day that has, kind of like St. Valentine's Day, has little, if anything, to do with the original character?
Yes, right. Well, the other big legend, I mean, the shamrock, the legend of the shamrock, the three-leaf clover, is, as I said earlier, associated with his using it sort of as an illustration to teach converts the doctrine of the Trinity, that one clover, yet three leaves. And, you know, as pastors, we've all looked for a simple illustration. And who knows if Patrick actually did that or not, but this was a legend associated with him. The other big story, really, associated with Patrick is the idea that he banished all the snakes from Ireland. It is a biological fact that there are no snakes in Ireland. God didn't place any there, or however that came about. But so the legend developed that Patrick himself had banished them all, which is a very interesting story. Of course, false, almost certainly. But underneath, you know, a lot of these legends historically are almost certainly false. Yet many of them, in a lot of legends of the saints, have some sort of grain of truth or a spiritual truth in there, you know, if you peel off everything. And, you know, there were pagan religions and in Ireland, and that's where Patrick went to work, and he was converting pagans, druids, who were nature worshipers and other things, and involved in their worship, these druids were snakes, and symbols of snakes were apparently part of their religion. So as he was doing combat against this religion and accepting converts and baptizing them, he was, in a sense, banishing the snakes from Ireland, the snakes of the druids. And even if we go even to a even more simpler level than that, as he was a missionary and bringing people to Christ and into the church, he was battling Satan, which certainly the serpent is a symbol of that as well. So almost, you know, a legend, clearly, yet still a grain of truth there.
We run into this problem with several modern-day holidays that have been kind of co-opted by the culture to become something entirely different. Some of these holidays take on almost a spring break quality nowadays, mm-hmm. namely Mardi Gras, which would be the Tuesday before the celebration of Lent, and St. Patrick's Day. It almost is associated directly now with some form of mild debauchery.
Yes.
Can you build a bridge back? The Christian who says, what Christian in their right mind would celebrate St. Patrick's Day, given its associations now? Can you build a bridge back to a proper observation of remembering this 5th century Christian missionary as we ought to?
Well, I think he's a wonderful figure in the church to be celebrated, and certainly, you know, celebration of him, and he's all mixed up with Irish nationality and Irish pride, and that's where most, you know, the cultural trappings come from, have very little to do with with St. Patrick as a saint and more to do with him as a patron saint or even as a symbol of national pride, almost like an Uncle Sam for us, only in a different way. A proper celebration of St. Patrick would acknowledge, I think, his role as a missionary. I mean, I've always thought St. Patrick and even the tradition that he spawned is one that celebrates the missionary zeal of the church, which has always been with the church from the Book of Acts onward. And St. Patrick was, first and foremost, was a missionary, as I was speaking earlier about his work among the Druids. I mean, Ireland had a tiny Christian community, but Patrick went and worked amongst the pagans in the north of Ireland. The Christian community was in the south. And by all accounts, was a remarkable man and fearless, and preached the gospel. History's kind of blank after he's gone. After he died, in the 5th century. But about 100 years later, we start to get documents again, and the Irish Church is strong, flourishing, and begin to send missionaries to Scotland at this time, onto the continent in Europe. The monastic tradition, just strongly missionary, and I think you can trace that to Patrick. And, if I was celebrating St. Patrick, and if I was preaching a sermon, it would be, that thing I would highlight, go therefore and make disciples, baptizing. Patrick says he baptized thousands, he ordained priests, he set up churches, and that's his legacy. And by the way, when you read his confession, a very humble man, unlearned. It is, many of the things we have from the early church are written by people very educated, highly polished Latin or Greek. And he was an unlearned man, a shepherd, but God used him to do remarkable things.
Folks, we have a few minutes left in our conversation with Pastor Greg Alms on St. Patrick. We'll respond to your phone calls and to your email on St. Patrick for the next 10 minutes of the program or so. IssuesETC@KFUO.org is our in-studio email address. You can use the phone numbers 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I guess that raises the question, why would the church remember saints' days at all? St. Patrick's is the one that's kind of hard to do because getting people together on a day where they're probably making their corned beef and cabbage at home is a little difficult. But why does the church in the 21st century bother to even remember a Christian missionary, as remarkable as he is, from the 5th?
Yes, good question. And we certainly want to disassociate ourselves from any sort of practice of the Roman Catholic Church or the Orthodox Church, where saints are venerated, prayed to, relied on, trusted for salvation and other things that are not only in the Bible but contrary to it. But we do remember the saints because God uses people to do His work, and the gospel is preached and shared, and people are brought to faith through the Holy Spirit, who works through people. And that's what the saints were, sinful human beings, whom God used. And we remember the saints in the Bible, who were fallible, but instruments of God's grace and mercy. And in the same, God has set up his church, brought people to faith in all centuries. And as we hear their stories, we give thanks to God that God has used such men and women to strengthen His church, and through that chain, He brings us to faith too, through pastors, through parents, through Sunday school teachers, even today. So we remember and give thanks to God for the work that He has done, and we seek to imitate their virtues, the things that God has done through them, and seek to follow them in the things they did following Christ.
Pastor Greg Alms is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Catawba, North Carolina. He's author of the blog called Incarnatus Est. I do encourage you to check out that blog tonight. When you go home, there's tremendous information there. He has some very interesting things to say. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, thank you. Always glad to be with you.
One of the greatest dangers that the church faces in any age is to divorce itself from the ages past. The 5th century does seem like a long time ago. It is. It's a long time ago. And Ireland's a long ways away, and it would be easy for the church to say, well, you know, Patrick's just become like Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. What would be the use of even trying to go back and connect ourselves to the history of Christians who have gone before us? Well, at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they realize that that is one of the greatest temptations the church faces and one to which the church should never submit, forgetting the saints that have come before us and forgetting our history as Christians. The old adage is true in the church as it is in society. If you forget it, you repeat it, especially with our history. At Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they are training men who have a true historic understanding of the historic Christian faith and practice. Find out more about them by going to our website, issuesetc.org, or calling them 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. When we come back from this break, we're going to start our series with Dr. Stephen Hine. It'll be an hour long to begin with. We're going to talk about moralism. It's the first part in a series on man's failed attempts to reach or to please God. It'll be very interesting. Dr. Stephen Hine is one of our favorite guests. He's director of the Concordia Institute for Christian Studies. Well, in advance of St. Patrick's Day, I'll just read a few stanzas of Patrick's breastplate. And this is a rather wooden translation, but I think it is powerful nonetheless. I arise today through the mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness of the Creator of creation. I arise today through the strength of Christ's birth with his baptism, through the strength of his crucifixion with his burial, through the strength of his resurrection with his ascension, through the strength of his descent for the judgment of doom. I arise today through God's strength to pilot me, God's might to uphold me, God's wisdom to guide me, God's eye to look before me, God's ear to hear me, God's word to speak to me, God's hand to guard me, God's way to lie before me, God's shield to protect me, God's host to save me from the snares of the devil, from temptation of vices, from everyone who shall wish me ill, afar and anear. Alone and in a multitude, I summon today all these powers between me and those evils. Christ to shield me today against poisoning, against burning, against drowning, against wounding, so there come to me an abundance of reward. Christ with me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ in me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ on my right and Christ on my left, Christ when I lie down and when I sit, when I arise, Christ in the heart of every man who thinks of me, Christ in the mouth of everyone who speaks of me, Christ in the eye of everyone who sees me, Christ in the ear of those who hear me. I arise today through the mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through a belief in the threeness, through a confession of the oneness of creation, of the Creator of creation. Think about that on St. Patrick's Day. We'll be right back.
The message is the mission. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Dr. Arthur Just on what a young man will find every summer at Christ Academy at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
It really does put him in touch with, first of all, a community of people here who love the Scriptures, who worship together, who pray together, and who enjoy, have fun, you know, doing theology. There's just a wonderful excitement and passion for the gospel that is expressed by them. But it is a way of a young man to shape his identity as one who is in Christ and to learn the Scriptures and have a real passion for the gospel.
For more information about Christ Academy, June 17th through the 30th at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Theological Seminary, 1-800-481-2155. 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Kim Troby, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. A new Congress, the same old battles. The Senate once again is considering broadening embryonic stem cell research funding. A similar bill was vetoed last year by President Bush, who is promising to do the same to this attempt. But Steve Jordahl reports that isn't stopping research proponents from trying.
The bill, sponsored by Senator Tom Harkin, is expected to get a vote this week or early next. David Prentice of the Family Research Council says it wouldn't allow scientists to create embryos to clone.
What it would do is say, as soon as you've destroyed the embryos, you can go ahead and have taxpayer dollars to do the research you want. It essentially rewards scientists for killing embryos.
A version of the bill has already cleared the House and has mustered broad support in the Senate. It does not appear to have the votes to override a presidential veto, which Prentice predicts is coming.
The president has come out strongly against this bill and has firmly said once more, if they send it to him, he'll veto it.
Well, here we go again. This is an issue that simply is beaten around every time Congress comes into session these days.
Kerry Gordon Earle of Focus on the Family Action says the rhetoric of the debate is likely to wander a bit from the truth.
Every time this bill comes up, I'm amazed at some of the totally inaccurate, unscientific statements that will come out of the mouths of members of Congress. I have heard things said that would make a scientist's hair curl because they are so inaccurate and so just provocative to try to get people to vote with the position that it's okay to fund the killing of human embryos.
State and federal funding of the research is already in the billions of dollars. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Ethicist Robert George and Father Thomas Berg have set out facts they contend both sides of the stem cell debate can agree on. They include the human embryo is due at least some degree of moral status and that there are non-controversial alternatives worth exploring. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
It's a classic edition of Focus on the Family. On the next Flashback Friday, join Dr. James Dobson for a conversation he had with the Reverend Earl Lee in 1977 that's still relevant today. Find out what is the foundation of the home and how you can protect your family in today's society. That's Flashback Friday on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is underwritten in part by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for March, Easter Is For Me. For more information, look for the Easter Is For Me cover on our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Easter Is For Me by Dandy Daly Mackle. It's a helpful resource to help teach young children about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Easter Is For Me.
Oh, you can find this all over the place. Unfortunately, this is a biblical image that is taken and used to a terrible end, a very unbiblical end. The image is of Jacob's ladder. Of course, Jacob's ladder is a true story from the Old Testament where Jacob awakes or in the midst of a dream sees this ladder set with its feet upon the earth and its top in the heavens. And at the top there is the Almighty, his God. This image has been borrowed, sad to say, by Christians to explain perhaps a way that you might find God. You'll know the hymn, we are climbing Jacob's ladder, rung by rung, climbing up, climbing up. It's us, God, coming up to God. And although Christians are singing it, sad to say, it is a very unchristian notion. In fact, there have been observed three ladders that men construct to try and reach God. All of them are false. We're going to be talking about them with Dr. Stephen Hine, beginning with moralism today. Dr. Stephen Hine is a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. Spent 24 years as a professor of theology at Concordia University of Chicago, and he's director of the Concordia Institute for Christian Studies. You can join us. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Hine, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be with you this afternoon.
Well, the first ladder we're going to talk about, a false way of man seeking God, is moralism. Can you give us an example from God's Word of a moralist?
Sure. I think probably the moralist movement, as always, kind of a side note that has been plaguing the church through the centuries, is first found in the New Testament. If we turn to the book of Galatians, this group known as the Judaizers, who were undermining Paul's ministry of the gospel, were probably the first organized movement of what we would call the moralist approach in trying to bridge the gulf between man and God. And the Judaizers had a program whereby they wished to understand Jesus as a divine assistant who would help us do what they could not do in the Old Testament, and that is totally and completely make ourselves acceptable to God on the basis of the provisions of the law. With Jesus' guidance and with his power and assistance, we can do this. So that in order to become a good Christian, what you needed to do was to enlist your commitment to the provisions of the law, and Jesus would help you, and this would bridge the gap between man and God.
Okay, so we're starting this three-part series on man's false views of how to reach God, calling them kind of the man-made ladders to God. Tell us briefly about each of these three: moralism, speculation, and mysticism.
Sure. If we wanted to think in terms of three different areas within a human being that is often seen, or three areas that are often seen as the important religious center within a human being, it would be to look at man's moral nature. It would be to look at our own inner emotions and feelings, or it is to look at our own reasoning and rational powers. Moralism is an attempt to use religious means of moral behavior and goodness and virtue that we would commit ourselves to and nurture as a means of achieving godliness and bridging the gap there between ourself and our Creator. Spiritualism wants to see the focus and center or the religious core, if it were, of a human being to be located in the context of one's feelings and emotions, and that we can bridge the gap between ourselves and God if we are able to make a significant spiritual contact in our inward experiences and emotions, and thereby bring about a lasting union and communion with God. And then lastly, speculation. We sometimes have referred to this in the history of the church as rationalism, has wanted to indicate that ignorance is the major difficulty that has produced a gulf between God and man, and therefore enlightenment on the basis of our own reasoning and rational powers can bridge that gulf and thereby create a saving awareness and appreciation of our Creator.
So, if
so rationalism, emotionalism, and moralism, each of these three become enticements as things that we can do on our own to bridge this gap.
So if we're thinking of the picture I mentioned before of the ladder, one of these ladders, its rungs are deeds. The other of the, that would be moralism. One of these ladders, its rungs are emotions or feelings or a heightened sense of being in God's presence, something along those lines. That would be mysticism. And the third of these, speculation, the rungs of its ladder would be thoughts about God, thinking correctly about God. Am I reading you correctly?
Yes, you are. And probably today, at least my take in looking a lot of religious literature today, even though it doesn't go by the name of spiritualism usually. Nevertheless, this idea that inner experience and our emotions are really the place upon which we need to turn our attentions in order to bridge this gulf. How often we see books out there that are advertising that if you will just follow the exercises and the pages therein, you can get a, quote, closer relationship with God and have a greater feeling of his presence in your life. This really is, even though it doesn't use the words, this really is that second ladder that we more historically have looked at as mysticism or spiritualism.
It strikes me that not only are there non-Christian examples of people attempting these false ascents to God among the pagans, but Christianity is replete with examples of Christians, erring Christians, who also are trying to construct these false ladders by which they can ascend to God.
Yes, in each of these instances, there is something that is in common. We may focus more today on moralism, but all three have this one element in common, and that is, in the ladder imagery, Jacob's ladder is conceived, regardless of whether you look at any of these three rungs, it is conceived as an instrument by which we, with God's help, with his enlightenment, or with his leading, or with his power, or with his something, but nevertheless, we are the ones who are who take the active role of ascending to God and thereby bridging the gap. Each of these really is a self-salvation program.
Do each of them involve, and let's focus here on moralism, does moralism involve a misdiagnosis of man's real problem and therefore a misapplication of a remedy to man's problem?
I think that question really hits to the heart of the issue, and I think that the answer to that question is an unqualified yes. It is precisely because of a misdiagnosis of the human dilemma. What is the nature and cause of this gulf between us and our Creator? When that is misdiagnosed, then usually the solutions of what will overcome it are also going to be things that are going to actually fall short.
How does moralism diagnose man's problem, man's human dilemma?
Moralism sees the problem that has created the gulf between us and God as fundamentally a moral problem. That is to say that human beings have a moral defect. And, you know, there is a lot of experiential evidence that we have just living in this world around other people and maybe even some reflective understanding about ourselves to recognize that well, my goodness, we do have a moral problem. The problem, though, is when the moral problem is seen as the root problem rather than just simply as the presenting symptom. The Bible wants to tell us that the wages of sin is death, and that death has been passed on from Adam onward. So a Christian understanding of the problem of sin, while it may have moral symptoms or manifestations of this problem, really involves a spiritual deadness. And when you think in terms of a gulf that involves deadness, then it is the gulf distance between death and life that really makes up the problem that we have and the distance that we have with God. So the moral problem is just a presenting symptom, but spiritual death, that is that we are dead to God, dead as it were in spiritual matters, that we can't do anything, not just that we can't do it very well, This is the difference between, it seems to me, the biblical understanding of the problem of sin and the moral understanding of it, which waters it down considerably.
So it's not only that moralism misidentifies the symptom as the malady, but it in fact underestimates the symptom at the same time. You just used a phrase, we don't do it very well. It seems as though moralism more often than not has a remedy, which is, let me teach you how to do it better. You're doing fine. You've fallen short here and there. Christianity, Jesus, is here simply to instruct us on the better way to do what we're already kind of trying to do already.
That's one role that Jesus has played in the moralist model, when the moral model has challenged a biblical understanding of the gospel and the history of the church. There's another role that Jesus often plays in the moralist model as well. Jesus is not only, of course, the one who teaches us by good moral example, but he is also as understood as the one who provides us some extra needed power to kind of get us over the hump, where we can't do it on our own, but with Jesus' help, with his power, which comes through prayer, or it comes through commitment, or it comes through this or that or whatever else. But nevertheless, Jesus interjects his grace, which is understood as a moral reforming power, which helps us to then make ourselves morally acceptable to God.
There's a big difference between the phrase, we can't do it, which is how God's law diagnoses our sinful problem, and we can't do it on our own, isn't there?
Yes. I like to talk about the helping people understand the importance of the word death to describe the condition of sin. There's a difference between sick people and dead people. Sick people may need some help. They may not get better if they don't get help. But nonetheless, if they get help, then improvement can come. But a dead person is beyond help. Okay, even God doesn't help dead people. He raises them up unto newness of life. And so it is to say that the biblical model of the gospel is that God does everything. We do nothing because we are dead in our trespasses, not simply in the needs improvement category.
So what is the cross to the moralist?
The cross becomes the example of great sacrificial love. And we share the love of Jesus with other people. Here, Jesus shows us that greater love has no one than that he would lay down his life for his friends. And so the cross becomes, as it were, an example to both inspire us and to show us, of course, the depths of godly love that we ought also have for one another. The cross also often is depicted as something which brings grace from God to us, which we don't merit, namely this kind of help that enables us to morally better ourselves. The idea in the medieval world of infused grace, the Latin word was gratia infusa, was largely conceived in this way. Because Jesus died on the cross, he did something over and beyond very meritorious, and this enabled him to be able to give us some things that we don't deserve, namely some infused grace that will help us become better people, that will help us become righteous enough to have God's favor.
So in essence, Jesus obedience all the way to death on a cross, to use the scriptural terms, in the moralist mind, is not an obedience that is a substitutionary obedience for my disobedience, but in fact merely an inspiring example and perhaps a means by which Jesus kind of frees up some of his capital to send our way.
Yes, he sends us some of his divine power, which has a transforming effect upon us, which together with our works enables us to climb that ladder between the depths of sinful living and the righteous presence of God.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Hine. He spent 24 years as professor of theology at Concordia University, Chicago, director of the Concordia Institute for Christian Studies. Part one of our three-part series on man's failed attempts to reach God. Today is moralism. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You can also email us right here in the studio. It's issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin, and this is Issues Etc. So going into our first break, how would someone know if their pastor is a moralist, Dr. Hine? What kind of preaching would you hear from a moralist pastor?
I think, generally speaking, if we were going to look at a moralist, we would find that characteristic in preaching and teaching, where Jesus is always being presented to us as an example of what we ought to do. And if we are committed, and if we are serious in our love for Jesus, then we are going to use him as our example and imitate him, and with lots of words to try to motivate us and to try to give us a picture of what wonderful things will come our way from God as we progress in conforming our life more and more into the godly ways that God's law instructs us in. This is going to be the method, it seems to me, that we'll see, and it's out there a lot.
If a preacher refers to Jesus primarily in terms of him being your power source or your helper or your encourager, is he also preaching as a moralist?
I believe so. Think of the difference between Jesus, who helps you become righteous, as opposed to the New Testament gospel, which wishes to proclaim that Christ is your righteousness, that he gives you his righteousness, and that therefore you have favor with God solely on the basis of his righteousness won for you on the cross, and on the basis, therefore, of nothing that we would do, not now, not ever. That's the real contrast between how a moralist is going to be looking at Jesus and how the apostles in the New Testament present him.
Someone might object and say, well, Dr. Hine, the Jesus you talked about, the substitute Jesus, the one who is our righteousness, that's the Jesus we preach to the unbeliever. But to Christians, we need to preach Jesus, the example. Your response?
Yes, I would say that when we are talking about the gospel only wants to make this kind of a distinction. It makes a distinction between sinners who are not repentant of sins and sinners who are repentant. And for sinners who are not repentant of them, the full force of God's law is brought down upon them. But the scriptures make no distinction between whether someone is a believer or not a believer when it comes to addressing the gospel to them. The righteousness of Christ is that upon which we live even after we come to faith, as the Apostle Paul well says there in Romans 7, for sin is still with him, as he confesses that apart from Christ, he is a sinner sold as a slave to sin, but then says, who will deliver me from this bondage of death? But thanks be to God that in Christ there is therefore now no condemnation. And he, of course, is a preeminent apostle. He is more than just a believer, a paragon in the New Testament church.
So as you observe the wide swath of popular preaching in the Christian church today, sermons that generally range from how to improve to how to get started, most of it is how to kind of preaching out there. Are you looking at popular preaching in many Christian churches being essentially moralism?
I'm finding it very moralistic. Actually, it's kind of a combination between moralism and what we may be talking about next week under the heading of mysticism or spiritualism. I think that there is a tremendous yearning of people, even in the church today. They want to feel better. They want to feel closer to God. They want to feel less bothered about their sin. They want to rise above the problems that tend to depress them and bring them low in their daily living. And they look to Jesus as an answer for that. And there is an awful lot of preaching that wishes to say that the more that we are able to follow the moral precepts that we find that the Bible teaches, God in turn will bless us with a greater sense of his presence in our life, with a greater feeling of joy, of contentment. And our problems of sin, both from within and without, will begin to recede, or we will just rise above them, and they won't affect us as they have been. So it's a combination. Do the moral good things, it's going to make you feel a whole lot better than you do right now. And it's kind of a combination, therefore, I think, between both of these two ladders that we have been talking about to bridge the gap.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Hine, part one of our three-part weekly series on man's failed attempts to please God. Today, we're talking about moralism. Feel free to join us during this break. We have 25 more minutes on the other side of this break with Dr. Hine. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Notice one thing that all three of these ladders that man constructs to reach God have in common, whether it is moralism or mysticism or speculation. They all have one thing in common. Well, they have several things in common, but they do have this one thing in common. What do you do with a ladder? You climb it, don't you? So all of them have this in common. We'll talk about it on the other side of the break. If a Christian is really a Christian, and if the Christian life is really all about ascending the ladder of moralism or mysticism or speculation, well, he ought to be able to measure some progress, right? After all, when you climb an ordinary ladder, you know the difference between being on the bottom rung and being near the top. There's a phrase that has gained much currency among Christians called the victorious Christian life. I think it has something to do with Christians thinking they've reached the top of the moral ladder. We'll be right back.
Grace, faith, Scripture, and Christ alone. You're listening to Issues, Etc.